All right, short message from my number one sponsor, NetSuite. Here's the deal. If you're a business owner, you don't need them, NetSuite, to tell you it's tough to run a business, because it is, right? We all know that. Don't let QuickBooks and spreadsheets slow you down anymore. Now is the time to upgrade to NetSuite by Oracle. They're the world's number one cloud-based business system. They give you the visibility and control over your financials, HR, inventory, e-commerce, and more. You want to join over 24,000 companies using NetSuite right now. Let them show you how they'll benefit your business with a free product tour at netsuite.com/wolf. That's netsuite.com/wolf. Hey, JB here, the Wolf of Wall Street, for a special episode of The Wolf's Den. Deserves a drum roll, by the way. That's how special this episode is. It's combination podcast, learning episode. It's just going to be me, and what I want to talk about today is a very important topic. It's a topic that I typically shy away from, but today I'm going to dive in deep because I think everybody needs to hear this stuff, learn about it, because I keep getting asked the same questions again and again, and what's amazing is when I start talking about this subject, it just absolutely shocks me how little people know. Even people who are supposedly schooled in this stuff and do it actually are in this industry, at least on a daily basis for themselves, casually, they do it every day. They have no idea what's really driving it, why things are the way they are, how we got to this place. So I think it's really important that everybody learns about this and understands what's going on. What I'm talking about is Wall Street. I'm talking about how stocks trade, why they trade the way they do, how they even come to trade. I think that people right now are literally flying blind out there without a cane because they don't understand what's really going on with stocks in general. They don't know how they even come to be. So what I want to do here in this episode is I want to just take a little bit of time to demystify Wall Street for you and explain to you what's going on, how this all started, and what makes the stock market work. All right? So let's start at the beginning. And for those of you who are bored by this, well, then just don't listen, okay? But to me, this could be one of the most important podcasts you ever listen to because we should all know what's going on in the world and how we go out and invest safely. All right. So I'm not going to be giving you specific investment advice in one stock right now, but I want to explain to you how the market works in general. So you know why things are going crazy with GameStop and things like AMC, what the shorts are up to, what the longs are doing, how the hedge funds operate, what's going on behind the scenes in the shadows, and why is it allowed to happen this way and why is it changing? All right. So let me go back to the beginning, just so you understand what happens on a stock exchange or on the NASDAQ. There's a difference. So the NASDAQ is what's called a decentralized stock exchange versus the New York Stock Exchange. Theoretically, everything trades in one place. Like, it's the New York Stock Exchange. Stocks are listed there. You have specialists in these stocks. That's where they trade. Now, over the years, that line has become blurred because there's a lot of off-party traders and a lot of things now happen outside the stock exchange. But just so you understand how it started, and it's very important you understand how this all began, it started back in the good old days with really two types of exchanges. You had the New York Stock Exchange, which was basically an auction market, where you have one specialist and a stock that wanted to trade would actually list on the stock exchange. And I'll explain what that means in a second. And then you could have the other model was the NASDAQ, which was actually decentralized, where there was not any one particular place. There was multiple market makers all over. You could have every brokerage firm represent as a market maker. So, for example, if you looked at a stock like Facebook, right? I want to go back like 20, 30 years here. So let's use Microsoft. Just easy to explain. Then I'll bring it current for you, right? So Microsoft, right? Let's say Microsoft was trading by $50 to $50.18. There's always two prices. There's $50 is called the bid, and 50 to 1/8 means 50.125 back when it traded in eighths in the olden days, right? So you had two sides to that market. That's called the bid and the ask. When you sell something, you sell it at the lower price. That's the bid. So you want to sell, you do what's called hit the bid. When you want to buy, you have to take the offer. So you pay the higher price. That middle ground between those two, that spread, right? That's theoretically where traders and brokers make their commission. So simply because there's a spread between the two, every time if you are buying at 50 and selling at 50 and an eighth as a market maker, that's how you make your money, theoretically. There's many other ways they make money as well, but that's the simple story. On the New York Stock Exchange, if you have a specialist, okay, is one person who's seeing all the orders. This is back in the olden days, right? And you could have a bid in the ask there, but they are both sides of the market, okay? And they're essentially operating as an intermediary, and they're looking at orders, and they are setting the market, one person, versus the NASDAQ. So it might be 50 to an eighth. You might have 40 people that are bidding at 49 and seven eighths. They're bidding right below that 50. So they're right below the 50. You never saw that. If you were just a regular investor, all you see is 50. But below that 50, you have all these other bids at lower prices. So when you sell into that bid of $50, right, well, you could sell a certain amount into that bid, then the stock would go lower. You would see the stock tick down. In the same way, you could see the stock at 50 to an eighth, right? There might be 20 other people at 50 and a quarter, three at prices above that. So all you're seeing when you look at a traditional, like on your phone right now, and you see a stock price or a spread between the two, you're only seeing the current best bid and the lowest offer. There's many, many other bids and offers behind that. So what happens is you have right now, you look out there, you see, okay, there are these two markets, right? You have the New York Stock Exchange, you have NASDAQ, right? Well, how do companies even get on these exchanges? How does it really happen? What's the difference between what's called a public company? And the term a public company means that, I know this is basic for some of you, but it's really important because most people have no idea what is going on. And because of that, you make really bad decisions. So a public company means that it's being offered to the public, meaning there's many, many people can buy that company. It's a public company. Any individual can buy a share in that company. A private company means that it's not available to be bought publicly. Because you have a very small number of investors that own a company, and the general public cannot go out there and buy a stock. Now, when a company starts to grow and they want to what's called go public, right? Well, what they do is they essentially list their shares either on the New York Stock Exchange, is one possibility in the United States, or another would be on NASDAQ. Right, they can make a decision on that. And why they choose one versus the other, we'll get to that later, okay? But the point is there's all of these companies that you see around you that are private companies. Many of them are smaller companies. They could be single owner companies, sole proprietors. Then they start to grow, they get bigger and bigger. And at a certain point, a company would say, you know what? I want to be a public company. I want to go public. I want my shares to start trading on an exchange. So what they will do is they will seek out experts who would typically would be lawyers, accountants, and also, of course, investment bankers. And the job of investment bankers is to facilitate these private companies to go public, to list themselves on the exchange. Now, in order to do that, to stop the massive fraud that can occur, you then have what are called regulatory bodies. You have the SEC. And then you have what used to be the NASD, now FINRA, okay? And essentially, the NASD or FINRA is what's called a self-regulatory body, meaning it's a quasi-government agency. This is actually the industry itself trying to set up rules and regulations to regulate itself. It's run by the members, like the inmates ruling the asylum essentially, right? That's one body. The SEC is a government agency. And the government agency has been set up to supposedly protect investors. So they have all of these rules they put into place that they think are there. And many of them are good rules. Some are stupid rules. But there are all these different rules and regulations in place that guide and essentially say what you can do, what you can't do if you want to be a public company. As a private company, you're exempt from those rules. If you're not out there selling your shares, you don't want to raise money and sell to lots of people, right? Then you're exempt from many of those rules. So essentially, and this is very, very important for you to understand, the whole basis, I'm going to write some stuff down. So if you're listening to this audio, you're not going to see it, but I'm going to also be releasing this stuff on video so people can watch because it'll be easy to understand some stuff by looking at it, but I'll make it simple enough that you can learn it either way. So the whole market, and this is where everything starts to get crazy, is that none of it is based on whether a company is good, bad, or in between. The SEC, FINRA, NESD, they are not there to make judge. They don't call balls and strikes. They're not saying, okay, that's a good company, I'm going to allow that company to trade publicly. That's a bad company, I'm not going to allow it to trade publicly. That's not the way it works. All it does, all they do, is they focus on something called disclosure. That means that as long as you disclose all the risk factors, you could theoretically say, this is the biggest piece of shit in the world, this company. If you invest your money in this company, you're going to probably lose it all. There's a million risks involved. There's a zillion reasons why. There's no shot. Everything from low, from poor margins to massive competition to lack of cash flow to inexperienced management. You get it? To being in an outdated industry, whatever. As long as you risk everything, it's all listed there one by one. The disclosures, it's called, right? Then the SEC will allow the company to trade publicly by issuing what's called a prospectus. So the SEC has a form that you have to file, okay? It's called, the initial one is a prospectus. It's just a fancy way of saying it's a form that basically explains exactly what the company does. It explains who the people are that are managing the company. It lays out who the largest shareholders of this company are, especially anyone who owns more than 5% of the company. It lays out all the risk factors involved with this company, and it also lays out all the financials. And when you have companies that want to actually trade and go on NASDAQ, be, you know, a legitimate company, they become what's called 12G reporting companies. That means they're actually filing forms every quarter and every year. So they're filing 10Ks. So when you hear about a company filing a 10K, all that means is that every year they file an audited financial report and an updated prospectus, which talks about the current state of the business and the current numbers. And then you also have what's called GAAP, generally accepted accounting principles. And when you hear about GAAP accounting, all that means is that they're using a set of accounting principles that are supposedly the same for everyone. So you're comparing apples to apples when you're analyzing a company's balance sheet, cash flow statement, earnings reports, and so forth. In addition, they have on these, all of these forms will have what's called the stock table, the dilution. So you'll have something where you'll have how many shares are outstanding, how many stock options have been issued, how many rights are out there, all the different possibilities and incentive and compensation plans, everything that's in there that could cause a company or allow them to issue more shares. So you have typically what are called two numbers. One would be the number of outstanding shares, and the second would be the number of outstanding shares fully diluted. Means if all of the options are exercised, if all of the bonds that could be converted or converted, if everything was converted into shares of stock, this is how many shares there would be. And then there are all these different arcane accounting rules that decide when you have to count certain shares and when you can ignore them. It has to do with price, what price the stock is at, and certain other things that dictate whether or not these shares can easily be issued. Okay, so just remember, very often you have companies that while they might have, you know, X number of outstanding shares today, they have a much larger potential to issue shares and become a much less valuable company per share fully diluted. Because the more shares they issue, the less valuable each share is. Okay, so essentially these companies, if they want to go public, they have to issue a prospectus. Now, that's if they are private and want to go public, without what's called merging into an already public company. And I'll get to that later. It's a whole different animal. And I'll probably handle that in a different episode here. But the point is that if a company wants to go public, they have to like give this, it's like this one time tell all, here's the good, here's the bad, and especially here is the ugly and all the risks associated with that. When a company does that, it does not matter how good or bad they are or what their prospects are. The SEC is obligated to to approve a prospectus unless there's something wrong with it. Unless it's, they'll give you comments saying you need to disclose more, do this. So the SEC does not give a stamp of approval to anything. Why is that important to know? Well, it's important to know because just because something is trading publicly, just because there's a prospectus on the company, does not mean it's any good or bad. Just because they issue quarterly earnings that are audited at 10 days, it doesn't mean anything. All it means is they disclose. Okay? So, how do companies go public? How does it happen? How do you create stocks? It's very simple. How all of these stocks, let's just use GameStop, for example. How does a company like GameStop end up becoming a public company? Very simple. They start off as private companies, and there's a few shareholders. And this is without even knowing the history of GameStop. I'm just kidding. Generally speaking, they start off with as a private company. So watch here. I'm going to turn the page. I'm going to write this down. So they start off as private companies, right? I'm private. And a private company will have, let's just say, X number of shares. And let's say X equals 1 million. Let's say they have 1 million shares. And let's say there are three people that own all of those shares. There's three insiders. There's a president, a founder, right? CEO, and one of them. There's three owners, right? That's a private company. Okay? Let's say the company starts to do well. They start to grow. And they say, you know what? I think it will be really good for us to raise some money. We want to raise money so we can grow even faster. Maybe we can make some acquisitions. I'd like to actually be public also. I could start incentivizing my employees by giving them shares of stock or options. So there's different reasons why a company goes public. Maybe they say, you know what, we're doing really well. I'd like to be able to sell a few of my shares and take some chips off the table, but still maintain control. I don't want to sell out. So what happens is a company that wants to raise money, get some liquidity, or incentivize employees, whatever it might be, there's many reasons why, they will approach an investment banker or a lawyer and find out, and eventually, if they can, go public. That's how it starts. When they go public, all that happens is this once private company with this million shares, and remember, this million shares, I just picked an arbitrary number. It could have been 1,000 shares. It could be 10 million shares. It could be 1 billion shares. There is no limit to how many shares there could be, because what you have is in every corporation, you have what's called, you know, your corporate indenture and your minutes, right? And you can basically have what are called authorized shares. And through any, you know, you could just say the board of directors, and that would be the people owning the company, right? Agree to, they're going to increase the number of authorized shares, so you could just keep issuing more and more shares. There's just nothing that stops a company from issuing more shares. Why is that important to know? Well, it's very important to know then when you're shorting a company like GameStop or buying GameStop, just remember this, either way, it's not a finite number of shares outstanding. This company can keep issuing more shares. It's not like an investment like Bitcoin, whether you hate it or love it. In other words, Bitcoin is a certain amount, it's a maximum amount of Bitcoins that can ever be issued. That creates some perception of scarcity. When you have a company that's a public company, theoretically, there is no limit. They could keep issuing more and more shares. In fact, I will tell you this, if GameStop stays up long enough, above its fundamental value, if it stays up for a prolonged period of time, mark my words, they're going to start selling and issuing more shares and raising money, which is going to hurt the people who are long. So you have to be very careful. Just remember, this number of outstanding shares can always change. It's not locked in because you can always make a motion with the board of directors and increase the number. Okay? So watch what happens. A company wants to go public, so what do? They approach an investment banker, and the investment banker says, okay, terrific. We have to create a prospectus. We need to get your company audited to make sure everything is as it should be. So they call in a professional accounting firm that will find out what the numbers really are using what I said is that GAAP, generally accepted accounting principles. You'll have people come down, and the lawyers will, and they'll write the prospectus. They're going to list all of the risk factors, all the good, the bad, the ugly. All right, and all the things that you typically want to know about a company will be in this prospectus, and then it's the job of the investment banker to go out and figure out what's the right price to sell it at. So what is that right price? Well, it's going to be a tug of war between the people that own the company. Obviously, they want to sell their shares for as much money as possible. And the investment banker, theoretically, should want to negotiate the lowest possible price possible because they want, because the investment banking client, they actually, their clients are the investors. They're going out to the investors, right? And they want the investors to get a great deal. And also, of course, they have a relationship with the company going public. They can make money that way as well. So they have sort of somewhat of a conflict of interest. But generally speaking, what the investment banker should be looking to do is price it fairly. So they want it to be priced high enough so the people on this that own the company feel like they got a really good deal and got the value for all the hard work they put in, but also that they price it low enough so that when the investors look at this, they rush in to buy it and they actually oversubscribe. They buy more than there is available. And if they buy more or want more, then what will happen typically is when the stock goes public, you will see it rise after it starts to trade. So if a company was to go public at $20 a share, it would go up in the aftermarket the way you saw Airbnb go up. They priced it at a level that, for whatever reason, investors thought it was worth more, so they rushed in afterwards and they bid up the price of that stock, and everybody was very happy. And while Airbnb, the owners could have said, damn, I should have priced it higher, they're happy too because their stock is doing really well. They made a lot of money. Happy campers, everybody, right? So that's what that price is. That's going to be a really somewhat of a negotiation between the people who are, you know, going public, the company, and the people taking the public, meaning the brokerage firm. And I don't want to get too granular here, but, you know, usually there'll be a syndicate, so it's one firm managing for a bunch of firms that are out there recommending the stock. Okay, it's not typically just one firm. But the point is that this is how a stock gets created that starts to trade publicly. A private company. This is, again, I'm simplifying things, and it's like your plain vanilla example. A company is started, it thrives, it's doing well, it gets to the point where it wants to raise money to go to the next level. They approach an investment banker. The investment banker looks at it and says, okay, I think your company right now is worth $100 million. That's what it's worth, $100 million. And let's say the company says, well, I would like to raise $30 million. So the investment banker says, fair enough. If you want to raise $30 million, then you're going to have to sell off 30% of the company. So what will happen here is they will price it in a way that at the end of the day, 30% of those shares went to investors, and the $30 million minus the fees went into the coffers of this company. So watch, let me turn the page. And again, I'm gonna give you a round number here. Give me examples, watch. So right, let's say you have early days of GameStop. We'll just use GS, right? And again, these are not the right numbers, I'm just giving you an example, right? Let's say the company was worth $100 million. Okay, three, good, right? $100 million, okay? They wanted to raise $30 million. So what would happen is that if $30 million was raised, it was $100 million, that means afterwards it would now be 130 million shares outstanding. Because you would issue $30 million more, $30 million worth more, right? And that money would go into the bank account of GameStop. So now you would have $130 million worth of stock. The question of what price is it at? Well, that depends. So what you have now is here's how you calculate a stock price. And this is really the most important thing of all. We get down to what's called market capitalization. So let's say you have $100 million valuation for GameStop. So here's what you could do. You could say, fair enough, it's worth $100 million. Let's price the stock at $10, and now the insiders are going to have 10 million shares. So now you have 10 million shares outstanding. Each one is worth $10 million. That means the whole company before it went public is worth $100 million. That's how you get a stock price and where the shares come from. Then, you say now the company itself, Not the these. So these 10 million shares are owned by those principals, those three founders. They don't issue stock. What happens now is GameStop, the company, will issue 3 million shares. They will issue 3 million shares at 10. So now when they issue those 3 million shares, $30 million minus fees goes into the company's bank account, and the number of outstanding shares rises to 13 million. So the post valuation is 130 million. You have 13 million shares outstanding, priced at $10 a share. If the stock starts to trade hard, let's say it goes to 20 now, the stock is worth, the company's worth 260 million. That's what's called the market capitalization of the company. The market cap. This is the single most important thing when you're looking at a company when it comes to fundamental value. How many shares are outstanding and what is the price of each share? A stock could be $5 a share and the company could be incredibly valued if there's 5 billion shares outstanding. That would be $25 billion valuation. Similarly, a stock could be trading at $1,000 a share and could be not valuable, could have only 100 shares outstanding. It's a $100,000 company. So it's always the combination of whatever the share price is times the number of outstanding shares. Based on that, you get what's called the market capitalization. And from there, all things start to be analyzed. All right, listen, this is a message from my favorite sponsor, NetSuite, an awesome company, part of Oracle, Larry Ellison, a legend. They're the best, right? So here's the deal. If you're a business owner, you don't need them to tell you that running a business is a tough thing to do, right? But you might be making it a lot harder on yourself than you have to be. Don't let QuickBooks and spreadsheets slow you down anymore. It's time to upgrade to NetSuite. Time to stop paying for multiple systems that don't give you even close to the amount of information you truly need to run your business the right way. Ditch the spreadsheets, all that old software you've outgrown. Now is the time to upgrade to NetSuite by Oracle, the world's number one cloud business system. NetSuite gives you the visibility, the control over your financials that you need, your HR, your inventory, e-commerce, and more, everything all in one spot, instantaneously. Whether you're doing a million or hundreds of millions in revenue a year, you can save a ton of time and a ton of money with NetSuite. You want to join over 24,000 companies who are using NetSuite right now. Let them show you how they'll benefit your business with a free product tour at netsuite.com/wolf. That's netsuite.com/wolf. All right, so here we are. We have a company now that is public. It's trading on either the New York Stock Exchange or the NASDAQ, or it could be trading anywhere in the world, right? And what you have now is two types of shares. You have what are called public traded shares in the float. So watch. Now, let's just say you have right now of these 10 million shares, right, that are owned by insiders, and you have 3 million shares that are trading publicly. So the overall amount of outstanding shares, and again, I'm simplifying this, there's gonna be other, you know, incentive bonuses, but let's just keep it simple so you understand the concept here, right? So you have 10 million shares owned by outside, by insiders who started the company. There is 3 million shares that is trading in public hands. That's called the free trading float. Now, typically, depending on the deal, depending on how mature the company is, depending on how tough of a deal the investment banker, you know, was able to get from this company, right? Those insider shares are going to be mostly locked up for some period of time. That period of time could be anywhere from 3 weeks to 2 years if it's a very speculative deal. Why? Because the last thing an underwriter, an investment banker wants is for suddenly the insiders of the company to dump their shares on the market because A, it's going to depress the price of the stock, right? The stock will go flying down because, again, supply and demand, when you dump supply on the market, it tends to bring a stock down. When you withhold supply, take it off the market and you create buying, the stock goes up. So the last thing an investment banker wants or any investor wants is to buy a company that just went public, and then 2 weeks later, the insiders who are the ones that supposedly know the most about the company and should essentially believe in the company, right? They should believe the value is going higher. Suddenly they start selling all their shares. What does that tell you? Well, despite that, forget about just the technical that you're dumping stock on the market, which typically drives it down. It's not a very good sign about what those people that are running the company on a daily basis actually think about the long-term prospects of the company. Why is that? Well, the whole basis on why stocks go up and down has nothing to do with Reddit boards. Seriously, guys, what you need to understand here is nothing to do with these short-term swings. Let's go back to the Warren Buffett model of investing, which I really respect Warren Buffett. He's a long-term investor that focuses on the old-fashioned fundamentals. So let me explain to you from the Warren Buffett perspective what really goes on here. How does Warren Buffett choose a stock? Well, forget about all the things like he looks for brand value and all this. Forget that. Very simply, when you're looking at fundamental value, what you're looking at is you're saying, okay, based on what the company's actually doing, how much they're selling in their product, whatever their good or service is, what is that company selling each quarter, each year? What is their margin that they're making on that product, good or service? And after all their expenses, how much are they actually making? What's the earnings? And then after they pay their taxes and interest, what is that net number, that earnings per share fully diluted? Meaning, what is the company really making per share? For example, if a company has 13 million shares outstanding and they earn $13 million net, what have they earned a share? $1. If they've earned $26 million, they've earned $2 a share. Earnings per share. At the end of the day, in the old-fashioned world, so let's stay there for a second, and from there, all good things can be derived, all variations. But the good old-fashioned world, the simple idea is that a company goes public, it gets money, it uses that money to make smart business decisions, to grow the business, to make acquisitions. So at the end of the day, these earnings per share continue to rise and rise. And because of that, each share becomes more valuable. As the earnings per share rise, each share becomes more valuable. And again, simplistic example, but you need to start there. So watch, what you have is this essentially earnings per share, and then a very important number called the multiple. What's the multiple that the stock is trading at? What's the multiple? Watch. Let's say the stock is trading at a multiple of 20. That means that it's trading 20 times that earnings per share. So a stock that earns $2 a year, okay, that has a price of 40. It's called a price earnings ratio, PE. Okay, of 20, it will trade at 40. So if the price earnings ratio is 20, that means the stock will trade at 40. If the PE is 10, the stock would trade at 20. If the PE is 5, the stock will trade at 10. So you have the earnings per share, this number called your PE, your multiple, take those two and you end up with the price of the stock. So when the stock is 60 and the company's earning $1 a share, that's a PE of 60, very high. So you notice that some companies will have very, very high P's. And now again, it's a very simple example because there's many other ways that analysts nowadays will look at value. They might use, for example, not earnings per share, but they'll say the company's trading 3x revenue or X times number of people looking at a certain, it's all these, like they can even bring that to how many people are looking at the website. In the old days, in the late 90s, they actually started creating all these ways. They called it eyeballs. It's trading 8x eyeballs. How many people are looking at a web page? There's all these different ways that people look to value companies. The most basic, simplistic one that we often hear about is earnings per share. What is the PE ratio? What's the multiple? So what happens is you have multiples for certain industries. For example, computer software. If you took all of the companies that fall into that industry of computer software, you get what's called the average PE. What's the average multiple? It's gonna be one number. If you go into the automobile industry, you'll see a different number. You go into the financial services industry, you'll see a different number. You go into the dry goods or your supermarkets, you'll see another number. You go into advertising, every industry, biotech, you'll have another number. So what happens is analysts as a whole, these people that are paid all to look and analyze the fundamentals of companies, they come up, and it's really, again, it's the market that ultimately decides this, but when you take all of the companies within a certain industry, so all of the automakers or all of the financial services companies, they'll look at all of them and come up with what's called the average P.E. The average P.E. of an industry. So let's say the average P.E. in the financial services industry is 5. I'm just making up a number. All of the financial services companies that are public, Goldman Sachs, this one, every one of them, right? They traded 5. Well, what you'll notice is that some of them will trade higher than 5. Some will trade substantially higher. Some will trade lower than 5. Why is that? Well, now we start to see, well, if people think that this is the best breed, the best of breed, the best one of the lot, they'll typically trade at a higher price. Then you have those that are probably the worst of the bunch that will trade at a much lower PE. So when you start to look at these companies now, people say, where do I find value? Why is something valuable? Why is something not valuable? Why is it overvalued? Why is it undervalued? Why are people crying about GameStop being overvalued? What's that? What is that about? Well, simplistically, what's happening is the analysts that cover this company and this industry, they are basically looking at the sheer, forget everything else, the sheer fundamentals of the company, earnings, cash flow, assets, the history, growth history. They take into account the future and what the analysts think. And they are often wrong, by the way, but what the analysts are saying is that this stock is worth no more than, let's call it $10 a share. And again, I'm just making up a number, but it's probably not that far off from what many analysts think it's worth. So they think it's worth $10 a share. And all of a sudden, the stock is trading at $100 a share, at $200, $300. And everyone's like, what the hell? It's not worth that much. Why is that happening? Well, everyone's, oh, it's a short squeeze. Well, Reddit likes that. Reddit likes that the people on Wall Street. No. It's much more complicated than that. Okay? In fact, the whole basis of Warren Buffett's investing philosophy is precisely this. Namely, that the market is always right. Meaning, Mr. Market, the market, the Wall Street, the stock, whatever the price of a stock is on any given day, well, guess what? That's what the price is worth on that day. So if the market for GameStop is $240 a share, well, guess what? The market says on this particular day, it's worth $240. Period, end of story. The market's always right at that moment. Now, there's all these different things that might have gone into what got it to that point. But the point is, on that day, the market says GameStop's worth $240. Because all the market's doing is matching buyers and sellers, supply, demand, and forms a price that's based on equilibrium. At that price, there's some sort of equilibrium between buyers and sellers. However, what happens is long-term investors like Warren Buffett will search for companies that they believe, based on all of the fundamental factors, earnings, assets, cash flow, management team, brand value, all the things they can come into to think about that might make a company valuable or not. They think that based on that, the company should be trading. In their mind, its value might be $100 a share. But for some reason on today, the market is saying it's worth $15 a share. So what would Warren Buffett do if he had that? If he's done that much research and he's so sure it's worth that much, what does he do? He buys. He buys the stock because to him, every share he buys, he's buying at a massive discount. It's worth $100 fundamentally, and for whatever reason, today the market says it's worth $15. Opportunity. Massive opportunity. Now, when Warren Buffett, a very important point now, when Warren Buffett is buying his stock, what is he trying to do? Is he trying to buy the stock and drive up the price? Is that what he's trying to do? Absolutely not. That's the last thing he wants to do. Why if you want to buy a stock and lots of it, why would you want to drive the price up as you buy it? In fact, you'd want the price to either keep going down or certainly not go higher, because if you drive the stock up with your own buying, you're paying more for your shares. You're actually causing yourself to pay more money. So what people like Warren Buffett do, and real traders do, they don't talk up a stock they like. Shh, they're quiet about it. They'll use accounts and keep it quiet. They won't alert Wall Street to what they're doing. They want to get in stealthily, quietly, because as soon as people start to jump on the bandwagon, what happens? The price starts to go up, and even they pay more. So it doesn't. So if you believe in a stock, the last thing you want to do is use your buying to drive up the value of the stock. It's not what you'd want. You'd want to actually keep the stock stable, and then after you were done buying, then you want the stock to go up. That's the difference. You don't want to make your own purchases more expensive. So this is the problem. So why does the SEC or other investors saying, foul, it's foul, Wall Street bets is illegitimate, they're manipulating a stock? Well, their case they're trying to make, incorrectly I think, is that if the purpose of you buying a stock is to drive the stock up, that's illegal. That's the way the law is written and interpreted. So if the purpose of the purchase is to drive up the stock or down the stock, it's an illegal action. You can't be buying or selling to move a stock. You should be wanting it to stay stable or go in the opposite direction so you could buy it cheaper. Now, of course, in theory, you know, you want it to go up. So there's a wiggle room there. But theoretically, I think you understand exactly what I'm saying. Why would Warren Buffett, if the stock was 15 and he wanted to buy lots of it, why would he try to drive the stock up before he could buy all of it at 15? He's just going to end up paying more for what he knows is worth more money. So the problem that the big hedge funds, the short sellers have, is they're saying, wait a second, they're out there saying, stick together, let's take this to the moon. You can't say that. That's not right. You shouldn't be saying that stuff. Maybe they're right, maybe they're wrong. The point is, these are small investors, and the context of it is not nearly enough to be breaking the law, in my opinion. But that's the reason why you hear them yelling and screaming that this is not right. It's collusion, they're saying. Bullshit, I say, but the point. Now, at least you understand why. But now let's talk about something far more troubling. And this is the other side of the equation. So you have Warren Buffett out there who likes a company, does the research, and sees that on any given day, the stock is way below what he believes it's worth, so he buys. But what about those people who are like Warren Buffett in a sense? They are managing a lot of money, but now they're out there and they see certain stocks that they believe are way overvalued. They've done their research just the same. Just like Warren Buffett. But based on their research, they're saying, wait a second, this is not worth nearly as much as the market is saying it's worth. We have an opportunity. Let's get short the stock. I want to bet the stock is going down. When you buy a stock, it's called getting long. You're long the stock. You have the stock in your account. When you sell the stock short, okay, you sell it, you don't, it's called being short. You're betting the stock is going down. So what you have now, and this is a normal, healthy part of the stock market, you have people betting on both sides. Why not? People bet the stock's going up. People bet a stock is going down. But unfortunately, it gets a lot more seedy and complicated than that, because there are the normal, everyday short sellers that are playing both sides. They're long and they're short. And then you have what are called short selling specialists. These are people out there, like you've heard, like Melvin Capitals, for one, Citron was another, right, that you know very well, right? I know some of these people. Their business model is quite different. They are looking, hopefully, what they really want more than anything is to find fraud. If they can find a company that has some type of fraud involved that no one knows about, and they're very good, these guys are very smart, they spend a lot of money and they spend a lot of time doing research. They try to find companies that are fraudulent in some way. Someone is stealing, they're overstating their numbers, they're not disclosing their numbers. So if the truth were to come out, or in cases they can't find fraud, but they just believe that the market is so wrong on this one, at this given day, they're so crazy, this stock is going to just crash and burn and eventually go out of business. So they start to short. How do you short stock? Well, remember, when you're selling a stock that you don't own, it's no different than anything else that you sell. You know, you have to eventually, you have to borrow it from someone else. If you want to sell it short, you really got to borrow the stock. Theoretically, you're supposed to borrow the stock. Now, there are some exemptions to that. For example, if you are what's called a market maker, all these firms that are out there, like on the NASDAQ, and they make markets. That's the phrase. They're on both sides. They're allowed to be short or long a certain amount in the normal course of trading, to facilitate trading. But that's not what's happening here. These are people that are literally investing so hundreds of millions and, you know, even billions sometimes. They're investing massive sums of money because they believe a stock is going down and maybe even to zero, either because there's fraud involved, could be accounting fraud, something else going on, or just simply a terrible business that's being overvalued by the market. So they start to short. But here's where the problem starts. Shorting a stock is incredibly expensive. So remember I said you have to borrow shares. Where do those shares come from? Well, they come from the brokerage firms have something called stock loan departments, and they take the stock from accounts of people who own them and are holding it for the long term. They take those shares and they temporarily borrow and they remove them from the accounts, most of the time without the customer's knowledge because you've signed some form, you didn't realize it. And often, even if you didn't sign them, they do it illegally. It's a really seedy business. And they then charge money to these big short sellers to borrow it. It's called stock loan. Stock loan is an incredibly valuable industry within Wall Street, and it's the most corrupt, seedy business out there. Often, no matter, even if you have companies that do not have the stock available for loan, the brokerage firms will work with the large short sellers, and they will allow them to illegally short stocks. And that's how you say, how is it possible that 200% of the company has been shorted? The reason is because the brokerage firms are in cahoots with the large short sellers. They are breaking the law flat out, violating the law. It happens all the time, and it's very corrupt. It's incredibly corrupt. And if you're a company holder, let's say like Elon Musk was going crazy with Tesla, and I love Elon, by the way, and I'm glad he gave the short sellers, you know, a nice dose of pain, right? But he was kicking and screaming, this company's being illegally shorted. So what happens? Watch the bad part here. So a short seller goes in there and gets really, really short. They borrow all the stock. They sell it. Let's say the stock was $30, and they racking up every single day interest on the short. They got to pay money to stay short. So it's not enough that they are right that the stock is going to go lower and a lot lower at that. They have to be right now because every day they wait, their profits, if they are right down the road, are ticking away and ticking away because they keep racking up interest and stock loan payments. Interest on their margin, you have to borrow, so there's margin interest, and stock loan payments they have to make. And it gets incredibly expensive for them to stay short. So what do? They act and do things to precipitate the downfall of the companies they short. And this is the dirty part of Wall Street, and this is what you saw the guys on Wall Street Bets having righteous wrath, or they were right, they're upset because they, what happens with the short sellers, they routinely find companies, they get wildly short, and then they start releasing reports that paint this ultimate picture of doom and gloom, probably far worse usually than the companies really are. They will actually plant articles in magazines, periodicals, on the internet. They'll start talking down stocks in chat rooms. They start doing all the stuff that Wall Street Bets did on one side, which is pretty legal, they were doing it. They do it illegally. They collude with each other, and they try to drive down the prices of stocks now. They call up the government. They say there's criminal wrongdoing. They try to get the FBI to investigate. They try to get investigations going all the time. I am not making this up. This is standard operating procedure for many short sellers. Not saying which ones are doing it, but it's SOP for many short sellers. Once they get short, they are forced now to make sure their bet pays off in the near term, not in the long term. And that, my friends, is the difference between the longs and the shorts. The longs, like a Warren Buffett, he's in no rush for his bet to pay off. He'd love it to pay off sooner than later, but he's not losing money every single day because he's probably not on margin. And in fact, the companies he's buying are paying dividends. They're more mature companies typically, and they actually pay dividends. At the end of the day, all value comes down to that, the perception that one day the stock will be large enough they can start paying dividends, meaning they will distribute money back to the shareholders. That's the ultimate form of value for big companies. So what is this called? The yield. How much do they pay back to shareholders for each share? Okay, I don't want to complicate the matter here. I want to sort of keep it simple with this one big difference that no one is getting here between longs and shorts. The longs are not in a rush. Other than that, they want to outperform the next hedge fund so people will have confidence and keep investing with them. The short sellers are losing money on a moment-to-moment basis every second their bet hasn't paid off. So they're forced to do things that are going to precipitate the fall of a stock. They get vocal, they get loud, they collude with each other, they spread bad news, they try to start investigations, all that sort of stuff. And it's commonplace every day, and it's still happening all the time. That is what caused the wrath of Wall Street bets. It's that activity for a company like GameStop, which frankly, you could love it or you can hate it. Doesn't matter. But it's not a fraud. GameStop, to my knowledge, and again, I don't know, it could be, it's not a fraud. There's nothing wrong with GameStop. Other than that, maybe you'd say, well, you know, they're like Blockbuster Video. Fair enough. Okay, that, you know, they're selling buggy whips now in 1905, right? Bad industry. You could say that. You could say it's out of date. It's no future. The stores have been hit by the, but fine. They're all reasons why you say the stock is currently overvalued and going lower. But I'd be hard pressed to find someone said there's fraud involved, that they're criminals. That's not the case. So what happens is you're looking at a situation where these people got so short because they didn't like the company. They got so short and had to now pound it down, and they had to do things to precipitate the fall even further. That created the opportunity that Wall Street bets jumped into. Very smart people. I give them a lot of credit, a lot of respect. They saw the company. They realized what was going on. They saw how short the short sellers were. And remember, what happens when you're short? Eventually, you got to buy it back. You have to cover your short. So if something has a large short interest, as the phrase goes, well, guess what? That's built-in buying. And at some point in time, people have to buy back and cover their shorts. If you can get a stock moving up quickly in the right direction, going up, and you have short sells that are all on margin, well, what happens? They start getting calls from their brokerage firms, their investment bank, saying, hey, you're in a huge loss position in your account. You need to put more money in to cover the margin. You're losing money. You have to cover your margin. And then it keeps going up more. And they say, you got to, and then it gets to a certain point where they have no more money to put in. They say, hey, buddy, you have to cover your short now. If you don't send in more money, we're going to go out for you into the market and start buying stock. And we even will pay above the bar because you've got to cover your short. You have an open short position, and now we're even getting pressure for you to deliver those securities. Whole other side I'll get into later about stock deliveries and failures to deliver and so forth. But for today, I just want to stick with this. So what happens is, at a certain point, companies like a Melvin Capital or Citroen, they're saying, I either have two options. I got to pour more money in, or I got to start buying and cover my short and take my losses. That's what happened when the stock started going flying up into the hundreds of dollars a share at the same time as Wall Street bets is smelling blood. So what happens? Other smart investors, institutions as well, start jumping in the bandwagon. They see a possibility of squeezing the shorts. And let me tell you guys, it ain't just the Wall Street bettors that hate the shorts. Wall Street, the traditional hedge funds hate the shorts as well. Shorts are not well-liked people, most of them. They are not well-liked. Why? And not because they're bad people. Why? It's like the person that's in the casino and someone's on a big roll and you have one guy betting, don't pass. Come on, roll seven. How much do you like the guy who's in the casino saying, come on, crap out? Well, everyone's got all their money on the table. That's the short seller. He's at the crap table betting, cheering for the thing to roll crap so you lose your money. So even traditional Wall Street is not a big fan of the short sellers, those types of short sellers. So again, other firms and institutions, I believe, jumped on and created even more pain, and you created this enormous short squeeze, which sent GameStop and other stocks like an AMC flying up to the stratosphere. But what's the danger there? Well, the danger is that at some point in time, the true fundamental value is going to be recognized. Remember what I said, in any given day, the market is right. Right? The market says it's worth 300, it's worth 300. But overall, the thesis that Warren Buffett has used to make himself one of the richest people in the world, and that all of Wall Street basically relies on, is the fact that sooner or later, eventually when the hype is over, stocks will trade at or close to their true fundamental value. Why? Because why would you want to keep your money in a bad company? I'd rather just deploy that capital in a good company with better prospects. Why would you keep it there? So if you look at the Wall Street bettors, the one thing I caution them is they have great emotion about the stocks they're involved in. Like, they don't care whether they make money or lose money. We're just holding this thing to the moon. If that's how you feel, great, then all the power to you. But just be aware that there's a very great danger there that at a certain point, if the company doesn't make the turn and does not improve its prospects, eventually the stock will go back down to its fundamental value. They always do. They always end up seeking their value at the end. The only rare exceptions are if you have something like, for example, out of China a few years back where there was a massive fraud, but the government stepped in and bailed out the fraud, so it was never recognized. In that case, the short sellers lost a ton of money and never recouped. But eventually, almost always, these stocks will crash back down to earth. That's an introductory lesson to what is going on right now with Wall Street Bets, the bigger hedge funds, and this battle between the longs and shorts. Now, we're pretty much out of time here. I'm just scratching the surface because there's another layer, of course, on top of all this. What about the options? Where do the options come in? Where do those options come from? How do I invest in them safely? Should I do it? Should I not do it? How can I hedge with options? It's a whole different topic I'm going to cover on a different day. The reason I wanted to bring this up today so granularly about, you know, where do companies come from? How do they go public? And again, there's a whole other way where you merge into public companies, separate issue. But this is just for everybody that's wondering, you know, where did all this start? Where did the companies come from? How do they go public in the first place? It's very basic stuff for you experienced Wall Streeters. But I guess most of you, I'm betting most of you don't really know the game that you're in. You don't know where the stocks are coming from, how they're being issued, and what Wall Street is looking at. Truly, what are the things they're looking at? Because I believe knowledge is power. And once you know this stuff and you become more educated about what the other guy is thinking, it's going to help you become a much better day trader or long-term investor. As always, my advice to you is remember, when you're betting on speculative stocks, that's what you're doing. You're betting. Be very careful. Don't bet more than you can afford to lose. And just remember that bulls make money, bears make money, but pigs get slaughtered almost every single time. You want to catch the end of the beginning and get in and get out at the beginning of the end. Don't try to top ticket or bottom ticket. Don't try to find that bottom tick and don't try to wait till the very last second and get out. That's usually a recipe for disaster. And with that, guys, we're going to end this podcast. I love you all. Be careful. Keep investing because I believe you should be invested in something, whatever you choose to invest in. Put your money to work, secure your future, and work hard. Take care.